Hi, everyone. Classroom educators and student administrators alike are steadfast in the viewpoint that student engagement is a critical driver for learning and academic success. Discovery Education's 2025 Education Insight Report observed that 9 in 10 teachers and administrators polled stated that engagement is a critical metric for understanding overall student achievement. That same poll, though, showed that 8 in 10 students struggle with classroom boredom at least once a week. This is a topic near and dear to my heart. If you've listened to the podcast for a while, you know that student emotional reaction to learning is one of the things that I've always been very passionate about in my own research and teaching. So we're going to delve into this topic today on this episode of Teaching Matters.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Thank you, Trinity. Joining me today is Sean Young, who is the Chief Platform Officer at HMH. Sean joins us from Sherbrooke, Quebec, Canada, which is just east of Montreal. Sean has served as a university researcher and lecturer, a teacher, and an instructional coach before founding a platform called Classcraft, which eventually led him to HMH. With HMH, Sean has, among other things, focused on integrating Classcraft's engagement-centric approach across the HMH ecosystem of educational products. He also contributed to various educational advisory boards, including UNESCO and Future Ready Schools of New Jersey. Sean, it's great to meet you. I'm excited to talk to you about the platform today.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Happy to be here.
Let's start just by learning a little bit more about you. As I noted, you were working at your university, and then you also went into classroom teaching for about a decade, it looked like. What led you down the journey of teaching and then going into sort of this ed tech space that you're in right now?
It's an interesting kind of journey. I'm actually a physicist originally, and I was studying physics and realized I didn't want to work in a lab. You know, physics is fascinating, but the actual day-to-day, you know, grind with machines in a basement just wasn't for me. And so there was a lack of science teachers in my area, and I just started subbing and, you know, got hooked, really. I finished my degree and then was like, I don't know what to do next. I'll just start teaching. And that started, as you said, a 9-year journey. I taught physics, science, and math, and at the high school level. And I got certified. I wasn't certified at the beginning as a teacher, so I got certified by doing a master's through that time, and was really fascinated with the idea of making school meaningful. Suffered from boredom pretty tremendously as a school kid myself, and. There's a lot of interesting stories about that if you want to get into them. But, you know, my idea was really to say, how can I make school meaningful for these kids? They have to be here, but it doesn't have to feel that way. And so I did a lot of different things. I created my own project-based learning curriculum. So we, you know, had, you know, 9 large projects throughout the year in this physics class, things like building hot air balloons and, you know, that type of stuff for Newtonian physics. And, and while all that was happening, I was also, I had a freelance business building websites and applications for clients. The way that started was my brother was a creative director in New York, and he would do all the like creative work, but you know, wasn't a programmer. And I'd learned how to program doing astrophysics. And so I just started helping him out at the beginning, and then that turned into a pretty successful consultancy together. You know, at the heyday, there was several contractors working with us, and we worked for Chanel for several years and did, you know, stuff like building backend infrastructure for their websites, but also like, you know, cool interactive launch of products. So all that decade, all that was happening. And while that was going on, you know, I was making apps for myself as a teacher. And so, you know, apps to grade faster, grade projects faster with like, you know, rubrics already built in and, you know, creating comments based, you know, click-based comment type of app, super custom stuff. And one of the apps that I built was a super bare bones for gamifying my classroom. So I'm a gamer. I've been still play video games every day. And I was just really fascinated by the fact that, you know, kids were These students were not helping each other. This is a super hard class. It's AP physics. They're not scored against the curve, so they could be helping each other with their projects, with their homework, and they're not. And so how do I flip the script from, competition to collaboration? And the way that in my experience, the best team dynamics are in online video games. So I borrowed heavily from things like World of Warcraft and Diablo. And, it was a very like, it was like D&D for the classroom, basically. It's like kids would be a warrior, healer, mage. They would pick a character class, and based off of that, they would level up real life skills. So it's things like handing in homework, a day late, or being able to partner up with somebody or get extra time on an exam. And the way that you would earn experience points and level up was through doing behaviors that made you a better learner. Define behaviors with them. So it's like participating in class, handing in your work on time, asking good critical questions, that type of stuff. And that was that for 3 years. I just added stuff. The students would be like, "Hey, you should add random events. You should do this." And I would just, kind of tinker and add it. And then after that time, it was really transforming kids' relationship to each other and to the classroom. So I made a little website just to like, "Hey guys, teachers of the world, here's a cool thing I'm doing. Maybe it'll inspire you." And the day that website went online, 130,000 people came to the website. It just, yeah, it was super, just started trending on Reddit. It was on the front page of Reddit Gaming. It got shared all over the place. And by the end of that week, 250,000 people had been to the website. And then the BBC called to like do an article on games and education. This was like in 2013, so it was still kind of nascent. And that's kind of how the company was born. And then we, my brother and I teamed up with my father, who's a accountant, finance type person. So we started the company and scaled that to 12 million kids and in 12 languages, mostly in the US, but all over the world. And it was really, I would say, the leader in gamification in education, hands down, especially since it was content agnostic, right? A lot of games stuff in education is like game-based learning, so like math games, that type of stuff. This was about how you run your classroom, and so anybody could use it. We had people using it, in first grade, and people using it at the college level, because you could just put the right behaviors, put the right, the right powers, we call them powers, the things you would, and then you could customize it to any learning environment. And then that company was acquired by HMH in 2023, and now I'm in charge of the platform.
We'll get back to this, but I just have to insert, and I'm sure that you're finding this interesting as well. I've been, like a lot of people, doing so much reading and learning about AI right now. And I just started playing with the Google platform over the last month, doing vibe coding with it. I have no coding background. And I've already made three apps, one of which is for coaching basketball, because I do that as another hobby pastime. But then also
You
a
sound like
couple.
a guy who has a lot of hobbies,
I
Scott.
do.
Passionate guy.
I guess when your job is going to a series of 1 hour meetings after each other, then you find other things a lot more interesting to occupy your free time. But I just find the idea of app creation, for learning and teaching purposes, it's been out of the realm for most people. I mean, you understood how to do this, very early on. And so, you were able to do that for your own classrooms and to help others. And now that world is opening up so much for so many people with, very little training needed. I mean, if you have a good idea, you can bring something of that to a minimally viable product pretty quickly. I just find that fascinating. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. My wife and daughter call me a geek because I'm doing it, but I will own that badge for right now.
Well, you know what? I think it's you may be a geek today, but it's mainstream tomorrow,
Yeah, absolutely.
and I think you're onto something. I think there's much like what I was doing. I mean, I knew how to code, right? So it's a bit of different kind of set of tools in those days. But now any teacher could just do what I was doing. Hey, I'm make an app to help me grade this type of paper faster, and here's the rubrics, and make the interface super streamlined. And for a lot of teachers, they have very specific, customized ways of doing things. There's universality, and that's a lot of what HMH brings to the table. How do we bring universal, integrated workflows to teachers, make their lives easier, connect that to curriculum? But for all the other stuff that you're, doing specifically just in your classroom as one teacher, the kind of the custom stuff, there's like a, HMH can a company like HMH can take teachers 80, 85% of the way. Every teacher's going to want to do the last 10%, and customize their stuff. And that could be, print type stuff. It could be, some teachers are more artsy, crafty type, and some teachers are more geeky. And for those teachers, it's now within the realm of possible to create all kinds of, interesting applications themselves. And so I think they don't need to become companies, and they don't need to become startups. What's really exciting is the potential for teachers to, without technical skill, be able to create real usable tools for themselves, and they're not necessarily shippable, and you wouldn't, scale that. But for you yourself in your classroom, like
Yeah, totally.
it's worth taking an hour and trying it out,
It is. I
It's
mean,
not that hard.
it opens a new realm of creativity for teachers if they, want to go down that. They can sort of, my daughter, who's a classroom teacher right now, her thing is that she saves cardboard because she has her students make models with it, and she's good at that. And that's her, sort of
Exactly.
jam.
That's her last 10%.
That's right.
Exactly.
Exactly. And for me, I'm going to go for, something that, like I think we're going to get into with, the platform that you've been running with Classcraft, it really engages students. Not that my daughter's cardboard doesn't. She's teaching seventh graders, so it makes total sense. Let's get back to the topic of conversation. Although I really enjoyed that little discussion sidebar right there. I was reading an article that you wrote that was on the HMH website, and you were talking about your high school physics teacher, Mr. Obi. Did I get it right?
It's obey, but
Obey. Okay.
that's pretty good, Scott.
Sean and I were talking before the recording started about my lack of French pronunciation skills. But can you talk a little bit about, his class? Because you made a point to highlight that in the article that in which you were talking about engagement. What do you remember from that class that, seemed to sort of click with you that keeps it in your memory this far out?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I'd always been interested in, science and that type of stuff. And up until that teacher, it was very theoretical, and it was, it's very easy to teach and learn physics, for example, as, mathematical models applied to the world, and it's basically just a glorified math class. And what he did was really, he was a tinkerer kind of a person. And so, like, here's an example. He realized one day, rocking on his porch, looking out the screen, window, that looking at a street light that through the screen, that when you do that, it actually creates a cross pattern. And it's because of diffraction and, tiny slits in the screening. And from there, he had the idea to take a simple screen like that, stick it on a normal camera, look at the diffraction patterns, and from there be able to measure light pollution just by pointing it at street lights. So you take a clear night, and then you do it again with, a screen on just like a, a screen, not like a computer screen, but a screen for. And so they he and then he made, little adapters and just gave that all away. And so what that created was is a worldwide network now of cities all over the world measuring light pollution, with 10, 10-cent technology. And so, we were part of the, like, and then he brought the students into that. So we, all the first measurements with that, we did that in here in Sherbrooke, and and further cohorts. I was like one of the first cohorts to do that with him, but further cohorts went on to like go to China and measure light pollution in Beijing, all of this from, and he had like dozens of projects like that going on. And it was just so fascinating to think about a immediate applicability and how meaningful it could be to, he could have just done that himself, right? But he really wanted to bring the students along, and he made a whole, lab class out of building these things and all of that together. And then really just how simple it was. Another one was, measuring the temperature of the sun to, 1% precision using just a magnifying glass. You know, the you go from like you read things like Large Hadron Colliders and Higgs boson and all kinds of stuff like that, and it feels like science is so far away, when in fact there's a lot you could do, with dollar store tooling, and he really made that real.
It's cool to hear your stories because I think about the great teachers that I've had in my life and over the course of the time that I've been in school, and there is sort of a common refrain that the teachers that really think about how to get every kid engaged to the fullest extent that they're able to do, it's something that maybe it doesn't always translate into course grades, but it always translates into memories. And in some ways, those memories are as important as whatever the letter grade is that you get into a class. Sort of
Well,
flowing out of
and
that.
to me, Scott, like the connection there is that it creates meaning, like he made science meaningful, and that's what I tried to do, kind of emulating that as a teacher. And so I think we think about engagement, and engagement is really like doing things, right? And then we like engagement in education because we could measure it, but really what we care about is meaning and intrinsic motivation and having students want to be there and care about being there and being, just like little kids before they go into the school system, want to learn on their own. And so I call that, creating meaning, but I think there's that's really an important dimension.
Yeah, you actually answered my next question, which was sort of how you define engagement.
Oh, there you
So
go.
not very nice transition. So, you're leading a platform for HMS, one that you created yourself. Teachers, have to deal with a lot of technology right now. So they're dealing with learning management systems. As I started to learn more about Classcraft, it struck me that that's not an LMS. It's really more of an engagement, tool for the classroom. Can you kind of give the 10,000 foot, picture of what that platform is? Because I think listeners and viewers are going to have trouble conceiving of it if they think about it in the terms of, what they used if they, went through school and had an LMS or something like that. Because that doesn't feel like that's what this is.
Yeah, so there's two parts to that. So Classcraft is the platform that I built in my classroom, and that became a company that was acquired by HMH. Now HMH has another platform called Ed, which is what I'm overseeing, and Classcraft has we've you know we replatformed it and integrated into that overarching platform. So there's kind of two layers of platform here. So Classcraft is the engagement and curriculum delivery layers. One of the challenges we had with original Classcraft was it was extremely effective for motivation. There's tons of research papers on it, thousands actually. And however, it required bring your own content, a lot of customization. I was talking earlier about how you could use it for a first grader and use it in with college students. That's fantastic in terms of making it really applicable to your classroom, but it does require work, right? So we got to a place where, a lot of early adopter type teachers who, were willing to do that, who saw the potential, did that work, had huge benefit. But there's a, as we know in education, it's a pretty, teaching's a hard job, and and it's a very time consuming job. So to go in and actually do all that extra stuff, although the gain is there, it's like upfront work, right? This is my science background talking, but it's like enthalpy curves in a chemistry experiment. You need to inject a lot of energy, but then at the end you get, a lower baseline. And so what the Ed platform does is deliver core curriculum, delivers assessment, delivers professional development, and takes those three kind of backbone pieces and integrates them. And so, if you do core instruction off to the side, and then you do supplemental on another platform, and you do your interim assessment somewhere else, it becomes very, very time consuming and janky for teachers to, connect those dots, right? Okay, so I did an assessment. What does that tell me? How do I apply that to the curriculum that I have? I don't know. Maybe I won't even do that. Maybe I don't even, I'm not very comfortable looking at data. So these are all the types of things that we take care of under the hood on the platform. And Classcraft now is the delivery engine for core curriculum. So where it was highly customizing, the stuff, what we did when we replatformed is package it with ready-made instructional sessions for whole classroom instruction. So taking the core program, having the classes already built, have the lessons already built, and then have a whole like presentation and interactivity layer. So we took the ethos of that, fostering intrinsic motivation, participation first, having kids create meaning together, and applied that against instructional routines in the core curriculum. But things like a good example is like, we know, for example, that a highly effective practice is a turn and talk. And what we see is that you go to a classroom and you see that teachers won't do them because, for listeners, if you don't know what it is, it's literally get your kids to turn and talk to their neighbor for a minute or two about what you just discussed. And they lose control of the classroom, right? Because, hey, how do I know they're not talking about Fortnite or, the latest brain rot video game? And, and then they're just all of a sudden, I can't listen in on everybody. I can't police the classroom. So often teachers will give up on the practice, although it's highly effective. And so what we did is we built that as an instructional routine through digital delivery in Classcraft. So one of the things it does is prompt students for an answer. So, now they know that the teacher can look at the work that they did out of their discussion. But the second thing it can do, and this is where AI gets interesting, because you could say, hell, great. So now the teacher is capturing all these conversations, but now she's got to like look through them. And she's doing that live in front of the classroom because it's meant to be, kind of a segue. It's not supposed to be homework. So she's doing that live in the classroom, looking at these responses. And now, in the goal of making a practice more streamlined, we've actually given her more work. And so what we've done is we've added an AI layer on top of that. So it takes all the student responses, summarizes them up, and then tells her, like, here's what your kids talked about. Here's the points that they, missed on the against the prompt, and here's some feedback you might give to the whole class. Just three bullets, but it allows her to, not skip a beat, right? And so it becomes interesting because when you combine instruction with curriculum, with digital delivery that allows for, real-time pass-through, and then you add AI on top of that, now you're creating novel experiences that are really hard to replicate without technology. Like, this is effectively allowing her to listen in on all of her students and quickly get a grasp of what they're talking about, which is something that would be impossible to do, especially in that time frame, a couple minutes within a classroom. That's what I'm really excited about, is being able to, take AI, take digital instruction, take best practices in pedagogy, the best curriculum, and combine all of that together to create groundbreaking pedagogy. And that seems, what I just described is pretty simple. It's a one button kind of thing in the interface, but what it unlocks is really some powerful, changes in the dynamics of the classroom. Kids know that their response is going to see we've had teachers reporting like they want to see if their response will show up in the AI summary. And then we had some like incredible, like unbeknownst to us benefits, like if students enter their answer in Arabic, it's able to summarize it as part of the AI doesn't care about
In
language.
English, yeah.
And so for like second language learners, now all of a sudden you have an unlock that was really not really possible to do. So it's a pretty exciting time to be building technology right now.
I have to tell you, when I was looking at the website on HMS, I saw that feature and it immediately intrigued me because, anybody that's using AI right now, one of the great things that it does is summarize unstructured information. And so just to clarify, so are the data that the AI, the model is pulling to summarize, are those things that students are typing in? So they'll do their turn and talk, like you and I, Sean and Scott, do the turn and talk, and then we turn back to our screen and then summarize the point that we pull out of it. Is that the way it
Yeah, they
works?
can also record audio. There's
That
other
is so cool.
formats than just typing.
That's what I was trying to discern when I was looking at the website, was whether it was also, capturing the actual conversation, which, from a learning standpoint is so fascinating. I mean, not to get wonky into theory, but, when students are learning a lesson and then they turn and talk after maybe taking some notes, that literally is the teacher understanding short-term processing in the moment. And
That's right.
that's always been the black box. I mean, teachers have always been able to assess long-term memory, but the short-term memory has always been a fleeting thing. You might get lucky and ask the right question at the right time and realize that, a student and probably many students are just not processing things in the short term. But having that type of conversation summarized for a teacher in a classroom is tactical intelligence that is, I think, groundbreaking in a lot of ways.
Agree. And you know, and kind of the underspoken part of it is, you know, a good teacher might be able to do that without this tech, but they won't be, even the best teacher won't be able to do that for all kids at all times. And so you have gaps. Even if you're a fantastic teacher, you don't know what, you know, Jimmy in the third row back, you know, is getting, because you're unable to pull all the students at the same time and process that information yourself. So I think what you said earlier about unstructured responses is kind of, that's the immediate win, because, you know, a lot of, you know, from a quick way to assess students, I'll call it formative quick checks, that type of stuff, it's been very multiple choice for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's because that's all we could grade at the right speed, yeah, you know, algorithmically. And it used to be, you know, HB pencils with the little grid, you know, when we were growing up. And now, it, you know, it became Kahoot type multiple choice, you know, interfaces. But now we're breaking into a new frontier where you can have unstructured responses, which was kind of, oh, that's so 2023. Yeah. Now it's multimodal, you know, really where it's getting really interesting, right, where, you know what? In Classgraph, we have this like input mechanism that is, you can draw, you can answer multiple choice type fill in the blank stuff like that. That's more classic, but you can also record audio. You can also just take a picture of your paperwork and just upload that. Mm-hmm. So you can work on paper, and, you know, we're actually moving into a place where the way that you do your work is not that important. And because we're able to process it with AI and give teachers insights regardless of the modality. Mm-hmm. And a lot of assessment and a lot of feedback mechanisms have been very, over the last, you know, few decades, really very, very, very dictated by the design of how we can process answers.
Right.
And that's created a lot of gaps in our understanding and a lot of, you know, gaps in being able to personalize learning, for example, because we think about personalizing learning as like giving kids the right work.
Right.
But, you know, one of the big things about personalized learning is giving kids a tool set and allowing them to decide how they're going to solve a problem. That's really critically important. And in our new math program is all structured around that at HM, to just letting kids choose the right tools for the right situation for them. And there's multiple good ways to answer that, you know, and I think that we're kind of at the very beginning,
yeah,
of that. And that's really exciting.
I think that process discovery is one of the things that, you know, like when I was growing up, there was one way to do it. And I think that, you know, obviously in a field like math or physics, science, there are appropriate ways to conduct an experiment, etc.
Of course.
But a lot of the problems that we confront in day-to-day life, there's multiple ways to go through the journey of solving, mm-hmm, that problem, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And I think that allowing students allowing them to have the tools so that they can discover their own process for learning, I think is so important. It does account for difference. It does account for people who learn in one way and not so much another way. As excited as I am, and clearly you are too, I've got to ask you the ethics question. So,
all right, let's hear it.
If you're putting student material into a LLM or into a model or into, mm-hmm, a system that uses a model, what is it that HMH is doing to, you know, sort of protect the students' information?
Yeah. So there's actually a lot of, so you're talking about the data piece, which is one element, but there's actually other pieces tied to AI ethics that I want to touch on as well. But in terms of the data, you know, for example, in Classgraph, we're not sending any student information. It's just the responses. So, you know, they're not connected to any students. The output is not connected to any students. So there's no, at any point in that round trip, there's no student identifiable data being, mm-hmm, transferred. HMH has a suite of AI tools called HMH AI tools, and those are all teacher facing. So there's no student data, you know, going through that either. It's things like creating lesson plans, that type of stuff. And then, for example, we have Writable, which is a product that, you know, takes student responses and gives them feedback while they're writing. But again, we're not sending the student information, we're just sending their body of work. So that's one way. That said, we always adhere to the strictest guidelines around FERPA, HIPAA, all that type of compliance. Through transferring anonymized data when you, if you do need to transfer student PII. But again, we really design the solution so that we don't have to do that. And most of the, the best way to avoid it is design so that you don't have to send that information. If you do, then, anonymize it, delink it, all that, those best practices. But, I think another kind of worry that exists right now around AI is having it make decisions as well. So, all of our solutions are making recommendations to teachers, and they can decide or not to take action on it. And so, for example, the summarization case I was giving just now, you it says, hey, here's what your kids talked about, here's what they missed, here's what you may tell them as feedback, but we're not actually sending that to students. We're not actually telling them, here's your automatic grade based off of your response. We're giving guidance to the teacher, and then she can, if she wants, act upon it or not. And so, our belief is really around, empowering teachers with insights, with recommendations, with tools for novel pedagogy. But at the end of the day, my belief and HMH's belief is that, teachers are at the heart of education, and that's where they belong. And our job is to help them, do their jobs better, not make decisions for them or, replace them ultimately. I think there's talk about some of that stuff and some of these more AI thinking forward type of schools. We see charters where it's, very computer driven. That's fine, but I don't think that that's where we want to go as a society, and that's not what HMH is doing with AI.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of important discourse in a lot of different fields. Communication's one of them, education's one of them, but almost every field's being disrupted by AI to some extent. I think there's a lot of important dialogues happening about what does that mean for the future of the people that are the experts in that field and that sort of thing. And sort of related to that, I mean, when, I'm sure that you've not only thought about where the HMH ecosystem is at now, but where it's going in the future. What do you think? I mean, if you were giving advice to, people that are entering teacher ed programs right now, what does teaching look like in the world that, they're going to be confronting in 5 years? What do you think the role of the teacher is, and how do you be an effective teacher in that type of an environment?
I mean, I think I'm not going to pretend nobody knows. Like anybody who can make predictions about 5 years from now is clearly not looking at how fast AI is evolving. So, there's things we know for sure, like kids will continue to be in physical classrooms. We need a place to put kids during the day. That is like a societal reality. Also, by the way, learning, yeah, I believe that learning, and a lot of researchers believe that learning is a social act, and doing that, in physicality has a lot of value. So I don't think that's going away. I don't think that, if you have a group of humans, then you also need another human with them. The teacher's not going away. So, but there is a wild card here around AI and the role that it can take. For me, I would say if I was, pre-service right now, I would say you need to know how this stuff works. You can't ignore it. And it's actually, to your point, where you could just start vibe coding and literally in a free, Gemini, you don't even need a pro account or anything. There's really no reason to not do that, to start experimenting. I think there's fundamental truths that are not going to change, like relationships are at the heart of meaningful education. Build up those skills. AI is not going to do that for you. You're going to need to manage a classroom. You are going to need to meet standards and all of that. So, I think you still need to be able to use a core curriculum, all of that. But think about what you can do, on top of that yourself as a teacher, and using, the type of integrated solutions that exist now in the market. So I think, and then I think having an open mind. I think one of the challenges, that I, you know, I was a pre-service teacher for several years teaching a pre-service elementary. And one of the things I noticed with those cohorts is a lot of people who study to be teachers, and this is a gross generalization, so you can flame me if you want, they actually liked school. They liked it the way that it was. You know, people who really, really hated school usually don't pick careers that land them back in school. you know, like I hated that place. I'm not gonna, you know, some people do, they want to go make it better. But like generally what I saw with these cohorts is that these are people who liked school, therefore they liked the way that it was. Therefore, they actually wanted to, you know, maintain it the way that it was for them, you know, 10, 12 years ago. That's what they want to come replicate in the classroom. And so I think that's okay. It's actually really okay to like the school. I mean, you need to like the school system to go work in it because it's such a thankless job. So that's okay, but you know, I think we need to be thinking about not replicating necessarily what we like, but to be willing to learn as we continue our careers as educators.
Switching gears, one of the things that you've mentioned, but we haven't really delved into, is how the gamification comes into this platform. Can you talk about that?
So games are really a fascinating medium. And they're fascinating for a couple reasons. One is because they're so prevalent. So culturally, you know, young people and now more and more old, you know, older people are this is a large part of, you know, how we interact with each other, how we interact culturally. You know, a cultural medium is defined as you know, an artifact or a way of being that creates common ways of interacting. And games are, you know, clearly part of the culture. And even if you don't play games, maybe you've seen the Mario Brothers movie, and it's part of our cultural ecosystem. So that's one. So the games are interesting in education because they're culturally meaningful medium for young people. The second reason that they're really interesting, though, is because games are really good at fostering intrinsic motivation. And so, you know, a lot of the ways that we get kids to do things, that we get them to engage, is through extrinsic motivators. So things like, you know, study, you know, which teacher has never said, you know, hey guys, you really need to study for the big test so that you can get a good grade. So we're using, you know, extrinsic motivators, or we'll use, you know, punishment. Hey guys, settle down or I'll send you to detention. These are extrinsic motivators where kids are changing their behavior, not because they want to. They're changing their behavior because of an external reward or punishment that they want to get or avoid. Intrinsic motivation is doing something because you want to do it. And games are, by definition, you know, not something most people get paid to do. They're something that they spend inordinate amounts of time doing because they want to. So what is it about games that makes that happen? And so games are really good at creating the three conditions for intrinsic motivation. So competency, feeling like you are developing skills or that you have mastery. Control, being able to make decisions. And relatedness, being able to have social constructs for sharing this. And so when we built Classcraft, we really focused on those three elements. So what can we do in terms of the interactions in the classroom and the platform that will increase those three dimensions? And the reality is that people are motivated by different things. Like, for example, when I play a game, I really like progress. I like games that you level up and you unlock stuff. That's for me. Some people really like games like Minecraft, which kind of don't have levels. They have no purpose. They have no ending. The creative mode really just is a sandbox and tons of hours being spent there. And that's where, because of the, you know, control element, you can do whatever you want. And some people really like the online relatedness component, like people who play World of Warcraft for 20 years and they're still playing. It's not because of their character leveling up. It's because all of their friends are there. So games are really good at different parts of that. What we did with Classcraft was create an ecosystem where reinforcing were different pieces. So you had an avatar. The avatar levels you can level up, but it also had a whole bunch of gear. So for kids who really liked the collectioning aspect of games, like Pokemon, for example, is all about collecting these creatures. Well, they could collect gear. They were on teams, and you couldn't win in Classcraft unless your team won. So for people who are more socially driven, that was a really important facet. And we actually had like a whole motivational matrix around these dimensions and the features we would build into the platform. We would say, okay, we've got a gap around the overlap of progress and social. What are we going to add here so that we could make sure that we had a rich enough ecosystem to speak to any type of motivation that a learner may have? Because often what you'll see in gamification, and this is why it gets a bit of a bad rap, is it's overly simplified. And so you'll get like leaderboards, and then it's like, hey, we'll give you points and you can have a ranking. That's a gamification. And actually, what that does is quite the opposite. So for students who are at the top of the leaderboard, they would probably already be at the top. Not necessarily, motivating for them, but they don't actually need it. Kids who are at the bottom, well, now they're just seeing that they're at the bottom and it's being publicly displayed. And yet what they actually do in that context is give up because, hey, no matter how much work I do, I'm never going to get to the top. So what's the point? And so something that's meant to be motivating actually creates disengagement for those types of kids. And so how do you get those kids motivated? Well, you put them on a team and now they actually have a role. And it's not just about their own performance. It's about, and these are so there's if you create a sufficiently robust motivational matrix around these elements, then you can actually touch every single profile of learner at least a little bit. And the goal with Classgraph was really to take the baseline motivation and engagement of the classroom and raise it at a certain level. It's pretty different than, say, a Kahoot, right? Where Kahoot is very fun and motivating, but for a very short period of time, right? So it's like a 10-minute a week type of thing. And with Classgraph, what we wanted to do was, okay, maybe it's not as exciting as, a full-blown digital video game type of thing, but it's prevalent, it's ongoing, and it's every day there. And so what you're changing is the dynamics around motivation for the baseline of the class versus, some of these more spiky, engaging experiences that are, a little bit more like candy. I don't want to knock Kahoot at all, but it's like a sugar rush as opposed to, a healthy meal in terms of long-term motivation.
Yeah, point well taken. I mean, some things like that, I like the way you describe it. It's a sugar rush. I mean, some things like that, if you overdo it, it loses its vibrancy. I
That's right.
remember back when I was teaching early in my career here, I was teaching a 400-person class, and I was one of the first people to use the clickers. I'm sure you remember the clickers in
Of
the classroom,
course.
right?
They
And
were so expensive. Can you
oh my
believe it in those
goodness.
days?
Yeah, and they were shaky as to whether they would actually work in a given class period. But we had those, and it was always the same thing. I mean, I taught that class for a number of years and had clickers in it for probably at least 5 years out of it. Different versions of it. Some were cell phone based eventually, but it was clickers still. Students would love it for like the first, maybe 4 weeks because it was different than what they had in their other classes. And then it just became, oh, we're getting cl clickers out again. That sort of thing. So I totally get it. I mean, the last question I have, thinking about it from the teacher's perspective, the worst thing a teacher can hear when they walk into a staff meeting is we're getting a new platform, right? And so,
Totally.
just sort of describe, what the onboarding process, can look like for a teacher or a school or a district that is adopting the platform. And then, what's the return on investment for the teacher, not the district. I mean, I understand achievement gains and all that stuff, but for the classroom teacher that's dreading another platform, what's the return on investment for them that you think is most meaningful?
Those are two really good questions. So there's a couple of things. One of the things we've done in the last year with the HMH platform is have a really personalized onboarding flow that is tied to which programs and which part of the ecosystem you have. HMH is a galaxy of products, and it used to be like go pick from your menu, and go into each one. And what we've created is an onboarding flow that like knows which products you have and allows you to like configure your classes appropriately. From there, we have an online learning platform. It's called Teacher's Corner. It's just like a community, and there's success pathways in there, which are, again, bite-sized video lessons for teachers, but that are directly attached to the stuff that they have, the programs they have, the solutions they have. Obviously, we have really good services, so we're able to do, in-person PD that could go along with that. And one of the solutions in the integrated platform is called Coachly. And what we do is we pair teachers up with a live coach through chat, and they all year they can chat with that person. They can do Zoom meetings to get help. And the coach, because they're connected to the platform, they can see what the teacher's teaching, see there's data there that allows them to be better coaches. And teachers can just reach out to them whenever they want. So it's on demand. So we have a really like great ecosystem there. As you get into the Classcraft part of it, what we've created is a few things. So one of the things we learned onboarding over a decade into these types of platforms is that there's kind of two things. One is teachers need a sandbox. So there's a demo class, there's demo lessons. You can go in there, you can delete it, you can do whatever, and it won't break all the other stuff. There's demo students, so you can see what happens. Teachers don't want to have surprises in front of the class. And so, why do they dread a new platform? It's because they don't want to have technical issues, which are unfortunately happen. But they also just don't want to waste time and look dumb in front of their class. And so how do we make that not happen? So we make it so that they can know what's coming by with these sandboxes, et cetera. And then we streamline the interface. So we're now bringing this into the HMH experience for Classcraft. We have like a more simple mode for it. But what we had in the original platform was four steps on your journey of mastery of the platform. And so we would start with a very limited feature set. And as you felt more comfortable, you could activate more features. So, and that, and we, the initial, the phase one was like, you don't even invite students. You can use the platform without student accounts. And then phase two was add students. And then, and then you could get more and more sophisticated. And some teachers would never get to the full blown menu of stuff. And that's okay. So you don't build a ramp where only the end platform with all the stuff actually works. You build a ramp where every step of the way is pedagogically viable and is okay. So we need to meet teachers where they're at, and then we need to create ramps for them to be able to level up as they feel comfortable doing that. And that could be a multi-year process sometimes. We'll have teachers who, one of the things we hear is there's a lot in a core curriculum. There's a lot of resources. There's a lot of things to learn. So how do we onboard them quickly so that they can get comfortable and then go figure out all the other resources? And that's where Classcraft comes in with the ready-made lessons. These are the essential sessions they need to teach. They could just get in there, poke around, and then press teach and get going. And so there's an art and a science to it, really, Scott, and the art is not being too attached to your product and being, actually being willing to listen to teachers and, be creating the right kind of steps in that journey for them. The science is actually taking the data from your platform and learning from it so that you can, use that to feed the art, and so we're able to see where teachers get stuck, how far they get in the onboarding. We made some changes this back to school, and we're seeing six times more teachers using the training pathways, for example, that they used to use. So now we're, because of how we've changed where it shows up in their journey, they're now having different behaviors that are more effective for their own learning. So it's an art and science, and I think that that's actually, speaks to a lot of education in general.
It
It's
does.
art and science.
Absolutely. You can't have one without the other and have a great experience for either the teacher or the students. Sean,
That's
it's
right.
been awesome getting to know you.
Thank you.
You know,
Likewise.
if you just get excited about something and want to talk, get back in touch. I'd love to have you back on.
Yeah,
We've
that'd be great.
actually, you'll be interested in knowing this. We actually had a couple episodes about Writable last year, had some great teachers from Galveston that were on. They were but they were awesome. And so it's been great getting to know some of the HMH services that are available. But you want to come back on and talk about anything, don't hesitate to reach out. You're great to have
I would
on.
love to
So
do that. Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, as you can tell, I'm pretty passionate about these topics.
Well, there's a part of me, I think all of us want to figure out ways to help teachers and students. So there's very much an altruistic, reason for doing what we do, whether it's doing a podcast or, helping teachers with products like what you've been doing. But then at the same time, it's also just exciting to think about what it's going to become. And, I'm sort of like you. I think that at the end of the day, teachers are going to have a lot of tools to work with. They'll have to be smart about choosing them, but the end result of that is that they can spend a lot more time in relational meaning making with their students. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I think that's going to be really gratifying. I mean, I look forward to the fact that my daughter's in her third year teaching and that she's going to be able to focus a lot more on who her students are and a lot less on the day-to-day mundane tasks that so many teachers are just inundated with right now. So,
well, and maybe one, here's the, you know, devil's advocate. We talk about that, you know, HMH is, that's our vision as well. Give teachers time to, you know, build relationships. Mm-hmm. That really is only going to be awesome if teachers get good at it, and they're not all good at it. And it's a skill, you know? So, you know, I think that it's one thing to free up that time. How do teachers then use it? And then that's where you get into like using it to coldly create relationships. That's really not what it's about, right? So how do you take that time to authentically, warmly, fiercely want to build relationships with these kids for your own, even for your own sake? Like, yes, for your job and running your classroom, but like you need to want to get to know them, mm-hmm. and you need to want to care about their lives. And creating room for that is awesome, but you need to also have that mindset and the skill set to be able to take advantage of that. So I think there's going to be some interesting opportunities there as well as we think about what teachers can do in the future. And I think a lot of teachers want to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure everybody knows how to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. My guest today has been Sean Young. He's the creator of ClassCraft and now also the chief platform officer at HMH. Sean, again, great to have you on. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Scott. Really appreciate it.
A special thanks to April Koska and Trinity Sweet. They're the associate producers for the podcast and run everything behind the scene. If you want to reach out to the podcast with ideas, comments, or questions, feel free to give us an email at teachingmatterspodcast, all lowercase, all one word, teachingmatterspodcast@ohio.edu. We hope all the listeners and viewers have a great day, and thanks for tuning in.